Hi, and welcome back to OTTB On Tap. I'm Neve.
And I'm Emily. Hey, Neve, what's on tap today?
Today, we're talking to Shannon Riley, a talented event rider and trainer based in Aiken, South Carolina. Shannon runs Infinity Sport Horse, where she retrains and sells everything from OTTBs to warm bloods. And she's no stranger to the competition ring, having competed up to the FEI level in eventing. We're so excited to dig into her training program, her approach to resales, and some important topics she's been speaking about lately on social media, like rider fitness and dealing with online criticism.
Shannon, welcome. We're so glad to have you here. Awesome. Let's start at the beginning. What is your earliest memory of being drawn to horses?
I just saw your answer.
Definitely was My Little Ponies. I remember watching that show as a kid. I remember my briars. I remember my parents made me a sawhorse that we had in my shed. And I remember just like spending hours out there, like writing up little training plans and little lesson plans for the horses. So it goes back a long time.
Oh, that's awesome. I think we can identify with that. I definitely had my Briar horse collection, which is funny. Apparently I didn't know this. My mom lent it out to a younger cousin of mine, and she recently gave them all back to me. And I was like, oh my God, I had no idea they still existed, but here they are.
Kind of I feel like, were you even a horse girl if you didn't set up like dressage arenas in your backyard and make your other pets do things the horses were supposed to do?
My dogs.
Oh, I did too with my rabbits. I wasn't even allowed a dog, so I had two rabbits and I would set up like show jumping and like cross country courses in my backyard.
That's so funny.
I actually have a big scar on my shin from one time I was jumping over garden landscaping and it was like concrete barriers. And I fell and I cut myself. And I remember coming in, Mom, I'm bleeding. I need a Band-Aid. I'm in the middle of a competition out here.
Got to get back on.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a very cute origin story. But were thoroughbreds always a part of your story, or did they come into your life
later? My first horse was an Arab. But then the first one that we actually went out to buy for the intention of eventing was a thoroughbred. He never raced, but he took me up through training level. And then I started working for a friend of mine who did a phenomenal eye in thoroughbreds, Tanya. She did sales, and that's really how I got into riding and learning how to ride thoroughbreds, because she'd bring in whatever she found, and I would ride whatever she found till we sold it along.
I don't want to age you, but did you ever ride?
I did not ride in the long format time. I rode in a long format later on in my career.
Okay. Okay, cool. Awesome.
Very cool. So who were some of the people, trainers, mentors, or maybe even horses?
So I rode with a phenomenal dressage rider when I was younger, Wendy Sanders. She was married to my eventing coach at the time, but she was phenomenal. I spent a lot of time lunging horses for her. I spent a lot of time grooming horses for her. I did not spend a lot of time riding horses for her at first. But I did learn the value of a good, solid dressage program. And obviously, I lost some of that along the way because she had taught me so much. But she gave me the opportunity to ride her Grand Prix horse when she got hurt. Yeah, it was phenomenal. Wow. She taught me so much about riding and about what I valued in the horses and like riding quality horses and really running a program, what I wanted to do, even what I didn't want to do when I had my own program. Ken Dirks was a huge influence in my career up in Chicago area where I grew up. I rode with him, through my first preliminary, and on a horse that I got from them. I had a trainer mare that spent more time on her hind legs than just about anything else, but I did get through my first preliminary with her. So yeah, I think those were some of my very formative sort of coaches in riding.
Yeah, I'm like going back into your horse history. Your first horse was an Arab, and then you had this really spicy Trakaner mare.
Yeah,
it
went for a long time.
I'm seeing a trend here. You've had a really accomplished career so far. Can you share with us a few of your competition highlights or
milestones?
This
is actually an interesting question when I was reading through everything, because I would tell you that this is where the imposter syndrome starts for me, because I would tell you that I haven't had a standout thing that I've accomplished. I was like, I actually haven't done that much. I haven't really won a big event. I've had some good finishes. I've had some great horses, but I haven't won that thing that I felt made me worthy
of being a professional, to hang out my own shingle, whatever you want to say. And I recognized it when I was like trying to write down what my accomplishments were, that I like need to be a little kinder to myself and what I have accomplished. I've brought probably 15, 20 horses to the preliminary level. I brought my last horse from 4-year-old to the 3-star young horse and finished in the top 5 at the 3-star level. Wow. He finished 6th at his first 2-star. It's funny, like one of my best competition memories, you were talking about the long format. I was actually winning the long format through the dressage, through the cross country. And my mare was owned by a client of mine, a very dear friend of mine. She was a Clydie cross mare who I tried to run intermediate before I did the long format and wasn't fit enough, wasn't totally understanding brushes. So I thought, we thought the long format would teach her a lot. It did. But in throughout the cross country course or somewhere along the line, she banged her knee a little bit and wasn't 100% on Sunday. And I was devastated. But it was that first time where you're like, there's no option about jogging on Sunday. There's no thought about it. You're just like, because a lot of people talk about, oh, it's the horsemanship. It's just, you don't even think about it at that moment in time. It's just the only answer for you is you take care of the horse. But it was that kind of, that so close to a really good finish and something. And she was a great show jumper. But yeah, that's still a key memory for me is like that sort of a thing. I always joke that I haven't won a neck ribbon. And for the love of all things holy, I want to run a fucking neck ribbon. Oh, I want to do
you want to do
so
your victory
badly.
Gallop with the neck
I did
ribbon.
Virginia. And, I wrote them a scathing review because I was like, I want a goddamn neck ribbon. And the next year I didn't have an FEI horse and would have had these gigantic neck ribbons.
Gorgeous neck ribbons. Oh my God, that's so funny. It's interesting that you talk about one of the most important moments being a feeling of not defeat, but it's almost like what alpinists refer to as like summit fever, right? So you get to that place where you're literally 200 yards from the summit and you have to make that decision that you have to make. That is the only decision. And any other decision would be reckless both for you and everybody around you. But I think the psychology of getting through that experience has got to be like transformational in terms of who you are as a horse.
Solidified having that client, Kate, in my barn for the rest of my career. She bred that mare. I'll get her baby. Yeah. I've had 2 other babies from her. Someone who's just endlessly been in my corner, probably because of that choice.
Yeah. And can you speak a little bit more about the imposter syndrome?
I was just going to ask that.
Yeah, because we
both deal
experience
with that,
this in a great deal in both our
people do.
Yeah, in our professional lives and our lives with horses and things like that. And then something that you said actually reminded me of when we interviewed Ashley Steele Norris, who has ridden at top levels and had a bunch of really great horses, and she kept gingerly referring to herself as a professional, and professional was in air quotes the whole time. And finally at the end I was like, you're a professional, own it. And I'm like, I pay you money to coach me, this is, I don't know. And so I think, can you just talk a little bit more about how you feel about that? And I want to just also just pinpoint the fact that it is hard to accomplish that goals when you are in an area like
I'm in
area 2. You're in area 2 as well, right? And then when you're when you're in those areas where like you're saturated with top riders and people that have a huge strings of horses, and it's like that climb feels
the imposter syndrome is something I've talked about, I think, at length. I had a wonderful business coach that I hired like a year ago to talk through a lot of this, because I felt like I'd hit a plateau with my business, with my riding. I was feeling really a little like I couldn't make that next step. I didn't know what the next step was. I didn't know how to like, I felt like I was in this rut of I'd sell a bunch of horses and then competition would fall apart. And the bills feel like they're insurmountable. And I was like, I shouldn't be struggling, right? Mm-hmm. Numbers should be working better. So I finally talked to a coach about it, because I was like, I think I downplay my own abilities constantly, because I think we all do. We were taught at a young age to not be cocky or overly confident or whatever, if that comes off as conceited or whatever that is that a lot of us, I think, grew up with. But it really, she changed my perspective in, it all started actually at a dressage lesson, because I went to a clinic And the coach was just like, gosh, not so much like, why are you here for a clinic? But I was like, oh, I want to improve my riding. I want to get out in front of people. I want to do the things. I want to be the best that I can be. And she was like, you're holding you back. And it was profound for someone who met me for 40 minutes to hold me on my bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're like, that's real. That's a real statement. You're like, damn it.
Because I was just like, am I holding myself back?
Yeah.
And I was just, I talked poorly about myself. I wasn't a professional. I sold some horses, but I wasn't all that good at it. Sure, like things have gone fine, but I wasn't a great rider. My husband's very quick to correct me on a lot of this. He's always, you are a good rider. You are a good trainer. And it is very important to have someone like that in your corner to help you get through a lot of those things. Because I think standing in the mirror telling yourself you're a good rider is hard. Standing in the mirror telling yourself you're a good trainer, that you're good at your job, those are hard things to tell yourself and believe over and over again. So I'm fortunate to have someone that believes that about me and tells me that on a regular basis. But I do think how we talk to ourselves has helped, how I talk to myself has helped me overcome some of the imposter syndrome. I do almost, I'm one of the top sale barns in Aiken in eventing. I am regularly who people recommend for sales. All of those are extremely hard for me to say out loud. And they're like, oh, and then you're like, oh God, that's like a terrible feeling. And then it shouldn't be. Yeah. I've worked really hard that place to feel like I can say those things about myself, to say that I feel like I'm a good rider, that I'm getting better at my show jumping. But it's so easy to put those like adjectives in front of them saying getting better, or I'm one of, or I'm yes. And I think, I think I work really hard to try and eliminate talking badly about myself in any situations. And I tell my girls the same thing, is that was a great ride. What was good about the ride? What was good about this thing? That combats when your first thought's negative. And I think that's a huge way to overcome the imposter syndrome. And for me, it's a lot of times I put myself into clinics, into lessons with people who I like would tell you that I had no business riding in front of, or that I like, they're just going to think of me as a name, but I'm uncomfortable. So I think that's a great learning opportunity for myself. So I think,
and self-talk is really powerful. I think people, because it's, except for a couple of people that I have met that don't actually have a voice in their head, that voice in your head, which I think is crazy, that voice in your head can really influence. Sounds nuts, but it really can influence you. You're setting your mindset and your day-to-day goals, it can really impact you.
I like that too, like the reframing of in a lesson, like you were saying, reframing it to be positive and not ever, like me growing up riding, it was, you were just basically constantly yelled at about all the bad things you did. And then occasionally they would be like, okay, good.
You did okay.
Yeah, like you did okay. And then you'd be like on the move. But I think reframing that to be more positive is definitely very helpful.
I think it shows up with the horses too, because I think a lot of times when you're, the psychology of teaching comes in, and that you're not supposed to tell someone, don't look down. You're supposed to tell them to look up. Use a positive sort of, something you can actually fix. I can't fix, don't look down. Like you've told me to look down and that's what I'm going to like do. So it's a little bit the same with the horses, right? I'll get in a really nice horse and feel like I don't deserve to ride it or something like that if you talk down to yourself. And then all of a sudden this horse is like acting up and you're like, God, like this is a well-trained horse. Am I going to ruin it? And it changes how you ride. So I think it's important for me too to just, to think more positively about my own riding and my abilities. And it really does show up in the horses.
Yeah. Sure. Absolutely.
So sounds like imposter syndrome has been a bit of a challenge, but are there any other kind of big challenges or setbacks that have
This is a good question, and it's something deeply personal, but I do think it's how I ended up where I am in my life. 8 years ago, I lost two horses in a car accident. I wanted to quit really bad. I've had some other things go wrong in my career, and it felt wholly insurmountable. It was my top horse. I'd rehabbed, I'd brought him up through preliminary. He broke. I'd sold all of my things to bring him back and do the surgery. That horse is, he was a thoroughbred. And he was the coolest horse. And I just had everything that could have gone wrong with that horse went wrong up until the point that he got hit by the car. And so I sent my going intermediate horse out to the East Coast with my coach at the time. And I was like, sell her. I have her for a client. The client doesn't want to really ride her. Let's sell her. And she was like, sure, no, I won't be selling her. I think I'll ride her for a month. This is like December. She's, I'll ride her for December. And then I'm going to Aiken. I'll bring her to Aiken with me. And you should come to Aiken. And I was like, with what? I didn't have any horses. My horse is gone. A really nice young horse was gone. I was trying to figure out how I'd make the money work. I had no idea. I had no plan. But she introduced me to someone named Helen, who is now a very dear friend. I didn't know anything about her. And I was like, hey, I'm like thinking about Aiken. Can you tell me the details? And she's like, call me. I was like, oh my God, who is this person? I want to call. Yeah, what a terrible idea.
Who wants to talk on the phone?
Her and Helen Helen Hill now, and another girl, Katie, had a farm down here in Aiken. And I don't really know how, but I managed to bring, I think, 20 horses to Aiken that winter. With a wonderful friend and groom at the time. I was a higher functioning depressive. Like I was barely getting out of bed, but we'd ride all the horses. The horses got work. But I think everyone who had a horse that I knew sent it to Aiken with me that year in an effort to be like, Shannon wants to ride. And so I came down to Aiken, and that's how I ended up moving down here. Eventually is just, I met the people, I met a community. Yeah. I had the opportunity to find a farm that worked for me. And I was living actually in Helen's backyard in a camper for a period of time. And my poor husband, like I had come down here and he'd been down here for approximately 3 days to shoe my horses at that time. And I was like, how do you feel about moving to Aiken? And he was like, yeah, sure. Okay. And I didn't maybe clarify that we were going to move to a shoebox, but, but yeah, so like, that's really what I feel like. If you can start from zero and still want to do this, a lot of the other setbacks start to feel slightly inconsequential, right? When you still have horses that you can kiss their noses, it's still a good day. And I think that's reframed some of my perspective in a bad day at the office. You think, oh, I got eliminated. I fell off. I did this. Mm-hmm. All of that is inconsequential in the big scheme of things. And it helps to bring some perspective to all parts of my life.
Yeah,
and I do think that the equestrian community as a whole can really support you in ways you never thought possible in your darkest moments of your life. And I've certainly been there in my own capacity and had days where Emily was like, I don't care what you do, just come out to the barn and go brush your horse or go wrap your arms around your horse. And I'm just like, okay. I was just like, oh God. But because I think at the core of all of us is you have to, I think, at least weekly tap into the reason that we're all doing this, and it's because we all just love horses so much, and we're all just that little horse girl that like could only
that
dream of what we
so
have now,
true.
Right?
Because it is like, just my the girl who was grooming for me at the time. God, she'd bring the horses up to the back porch so I could just like hop on. Yeah, she was like, "You'll
just swing
like,
your leg over, go."
And she was right. I always did, and like it did. I think if I had stopped in that moment, I think it would have been very hard to get back in the saddle. And I was very fortunate that I did just throw myself headfirst back into it all. And I was honestly, I was so busy, I didn't have time to be sad or think about anything all that hard at the time. But yeah, I had an incredible community that helped me through that. Like I said, people who had no reason to send a horse to Aiken were like, yeah, sure, take it to Aiken. Oh, I don't know. to this day, I have no idea how I paid the bills for that year. Things just, I don't know, it all worked out. I don't know how food got delivered sometimes. Like, it was magical, but I was very lucky that that everyone helped me to just keep going a little bit. And that's what I needed at that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I hope that this story resonates with some of our listeners and that it might be going through their own kind of hard time. And I really appreciate you sharing that story because I know it's not easy to share those kinds of stories, but we really try to keep it pretty real here on the podcast. And as much as we like to have fun and everything, I think humanizing some of the people that you look up to in the industry is really important. But
I think I appreciate you sharing that. Like you said, it makes it a little bit easier for other people to be like, I'm going through a little bit of a hard time. I've lost that heart horse. I've lost that top horse. It feels insurmountable at the time.
Yeah.
And you feel like you'll never find another one. Sorry, my cat is doing gymnastics on my lap right now.
Your cat really wants to say something.
It's really wanting to get involved. So you talked about the horse that you lost in the accident being the horse that you threw everything into. Was that a horse that kind of changed your trajectory as a rider? Maybe the one that kind of shifted your whole idea of being an upper level rider?
He's a funny story sort of all the way through. So I got him because my mom worked at a tack store at the time. And this guy had come through to pick up something from them or whatever. And he had a horse in the back of the trailer. And he was like, yeah, you know anyone who wants a horse? And my mom's like, yeah, my daughter wants a horse. Like,
and it was literally in the parking lot.
Bought him out of the back of the trailer. We should ask so many more questions. We did not. Oh, my.
We've been there. It's okay.
That might be the best acquiring a horse story I might have ever heard.
There was another one in Boston, Illinois a few years later that they bought in the back of a strip club. So really, it gets better by the story. But yeah, so we bought this one. Oh, and I remember it, like, so, and he's beautiful. He's black, all the things. He's just such a typey horse. And I was like, oh, he'll be an easy resale, right? So I like go to get on him the first time. And I like, again, I should have asked more questions. He was four. He didn't race. He was in the back of some guy's truck. So then I go to get on him. I was in that like horrible, like you're halfway swinging your leg over when that sucker bolted so fast and I slipped off backwards immediately, if not sooner.
He found out maybe why.
I mean, he's sitting in the mounting block why so he was for sale quietly. I'm like banging on it. Yeah, yeah, sure. And then the moment I was like halfway over, he was like, yeah, nope. Oh my God.
The story sounds familiar.
Yeah, we had one like that Neve was holding when I went to get on it. He'd run like 25 times and was a total gentleman. So well mannered. Like you never would have guessed it. But he was huge. He was over 17 hands. And we had one of those crappy little like two-step mounting blocks because the three-step mounting blocks were so expensive. A client comes out and she's, oh, would you get on him? I'm like, sure. He's so quiet. Like I hadn't been on him, but wouldn't normally get on one.
Course. And it wasn't like a VIP client.
Yeah. We knew her and whatever. I get same thing halfway on. Neve was holding them. Did not let go.
I did not let go.
I somehow got in the saddle. I don't know. See?
Yeah. No, I was cocky. I was free balling it. I just went like, gotta hop right on.
No, I think at one point, Emily, once she finally got in the saddle, she like looked over after I had like water skied halfway around the ring and she goes, you're still holding on. And I was
true friendship right there, really.
Yeah.
That's where all the training comes in and the muscle memory.
That's so funny. But yeah, so honestly, he did that his entire career. I mean, he was running preliminary and I'd have to go to the back corner of a field, find a bucket. Oh, yeah. Like Mr. Long, head of the Florida Horse Park, was like, if you don't make it in eventing, you really could take up vaulting. Because I just like on the side until he like took a breath and then I'd swing my leg over and then he'd go get like a 25 in the flat. It was lovely. It could have been an equitation horse. It was so nice, but always a dick to get on. And I like, this will tell you, I spent so much time trying to get on this horse from the beginning. I built an entire Sandman so that I could throw it on his back. Let me preface this by saying I did not comprehend how heavy a Sandman might be.
Oh my God.
I'm like throwing these like jeans over this horse. Oh my God. It was like, I gave myself a black eye. The horse was traumatized. Finally, I was just like, forget it. I'm just going to figure out how to get on. I was like working for Katie RuPaul and she was like, is it always like this? I'm like, and she's, do you want to fix it? I'm like, I don't think so. I think this might be
him. I'm not sure it's fixable.
I lose him at least once. I lost him at the Florida Horse Park one time or at the Kentucky Horse Park one time. Oh, and one time it was like the middle of summer. Oh, I'm in the preliminary or something. And at the Kentucky Horse Park, they have those little fences around one of the arenas. And it's like a bazillion degrees. I'm in my coat. Someone walks up to try and hand me water. And I reach down, bolts right up over the edge of the arena, lands on like the cement. I was like, oh my God, this is the end. Of course, yes, God bless. But he won about everything he ever ran. But he changed a lot of my perspectives on putting, this is going to sound, it changed a little bit of my perspective on putting all of your hopes and dreams on one horse and how every horse takes on
so much more than a lot of things do, right? We put so much into the horses. It's our hopes, it's our dreams, it's our goals, it's our aspirations, it's our highs, it's our lows, all on this four-legged suicidal animal. Which just feels like a terrible
what is wrong with us?
Losing them just feels like you're chopping off your own arm because there's so much tied into it. And you tie it into one horse, and God, that poor horse has like so many expectations in its life. And I think a lot of people get hung up on, obviously in sales, I see it quite a lot, that this horse has to fulfill these goals and dreams. And this horse, but I bought it. We've done all these things. Like, it's just got to do something, X, Y, or Z. And they can't comprehend that pressure the same way that we put on them. And it's hard to do that to the horses. Yeah. And I think he really helped me comprehend the pressure I put on them in a way, in hindsight, because I was like, God, that's too much to put on another being in a way, because it's just, he can't live up to all those expectations.
And he doesn't know what those expectations are, right? Like, he's just happy to see you walk in the barn every day. And it's like the best day of his life every time he sees you, probably. And I think a lot about that when you do have that one special horse or whatever, that you have to be okay with a life of maybe the only thing you're going to ever be able to do is see their head hanging over a stall door.
Exactly, right? Because he got hurt weekly, but we had a catastrophic hock injury. We had to take like a chip out of his hock. He had hole in his knee the size of Kansas at one time, and I had just come to terms nobody else could get on him, so I was just like, this horse is gonna live with me forever. Can't give it away. That feels like a liability. So I was just like, I come to terms with that, like, there may be a day that all he offers me is a snuggle, and that has to be okay with you in some ways. And that it's okay that if he doesn't fulfill those other things that you put on them, because he doesn't know, he's not, can't comprehend what he's meant to do for me. Like, it's a weird pressure to put on the horses that we all do.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
And we always say they don't know. They're happy just going out in the field and eating grass.
Yeah. Right. No. Like, right?
Maybe they do, but I don't think that. But they're not like, I'd like to go to Kentucky.
Him, and then I had another really phenomenal intermediate mare that taught me so much about the realizing that a lot of naughty behaviors come from pain, and that there's a lot more levels of things than just put it in some draw reins and fix it. It's just not very good at the dressage because we're not very good, or you got to be better. You got to train it better. You got to do this better. Sometimes it's just, God, like, her SI was a raging pain and she couldn't sit.
Listen to the horse.
And it's so, it's trying easy to tell you to, something. Like, try and be like, oh, he's just being a pony. He's being naughty. He's doing this. Like, why? Why doesn't it want to do this work? Yeah. Why is, in theory, you know, what if you do progressive work with a good trainer and a good program, things shouldn't suddenly get bad and violent and dissolve into a million pieces, right? They will, like, once or twice, but if every day things are going awry, you got to take a minute and be like, okay, so what's really going on here? What am I missing? Does my saddle fit? Are these the right shoes? Is it sound? Is it maybe sound? And I'm manufacturing the soundness because of good riding. Do I actually need to stop and address what this is? But she taught me a lot about that you can get a real long way with a kind, brave, honest horse. But there is a point where they're like, hey, so you've taken advantage of my good cherub-like demeanor. Yes. There's holes in my body. There's holes here. In the training. There's holes in my education as a rider and like horsemanship. And
I think I'm doing the fitness work and you're like, you're really off base. I'm not horse. You're just,
and you realize it. You're like, oh, like she just ran out of gas. She just didn't give it her all that last one. That's why she ran out. No, I probably didn't have her fit enough for her to get to that point and be a little wrong and still be able to jump. And she taught me so much about that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. If you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice about
get medicated
that you've
soon.
Been on, what would it be? Fair enough.
I laugh, but like I started taking meds for ADHD and it has been literally life changing. And you know, but like you
that's amazing.
You blame a lot of your like dumb behaviors like on that's just who I am. I'm forgetful. I'm this. And God, it would have saved me so many headaches if I had just talked to somebody
when I was younger about how I felt about things and what I was struggling with. And
somebody could have maybe helped me a lot sooner. And God, my life would have been a lot easier.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting. Like, I've been someone who's been very vocal about mental health, and I've taken medication on and off since I was probably 20 years old when I finally was like, oh, this isn't normal. This, what I'm dealing with on a daily basis is not, like, this would kill somebody else. And in the last couple of years, I finally had the money to go out and buy a trained horse for the first time in my entire life. And I was like, this is going to be so fun. I can't wait to do it. And I was so physically ill because my good anxiety, my anticipation anxiety does the same thing to my body as my bad anxiety. And I was like, I can't be sick going to try horses around the country. This is insane. And I was like, if this is how it's going to be, maybe I should just put my money in the bank or something. And so I talked to my doctor and I was like, I need something to just control the physical. And I just asked for what I needed. I was like, I need something to control the physical response that my body has to anxiety and worry. And they were like, oh,
that sounds
so
amazing.
A beta blocker. And I was like, yes, Emily can attest to this.
It's amazing.
I am a different, and it's nothing about my personality has changed. It's the fact that because I've done the work and therapy and everything like that, I have the ability to use coping mechanisms that I've learned without letting my body betray me in the moment. And yes, I still have worry about things that I'm doing, but my confidence about my capability and what I'm actually able to do, it's transformed. I would have never signed up to do the makeover, like just that on its own. I would have been like, nope. And so it's, and we talk about it. We talk about old Neve and new Neve. Yeah. And I want to, and we've talked about this on other episodes, but I really want
to think it's, I, to talk I've talked about it. It a bit on Facebook and whatever, but I used to just be like seven clowns in a cat car. It was just so many different directions. Yeah. Like the brain's here. This, I like couldn't just finish a thought. And finally, I was like, thank God for TikTok, Instagram, whatever you want to say. I was like, I could just try it. What's the worst that could happen, right? And I was like, oh, cool. I can finish a thought. I can go through a checklist like an adult. I can get out of bed every day with a purpose and not feel
overwhelmed with many things I have to do. I can make the changes. It showed up for me a lot in I used to
hate making phone calls. I still do. It's like still the bane of my existence. I like used to have to like write down what I was going to say. And you saw my stupid notes. I was like, I need a plane.
No, I've done the same thing. Literally script like a conversation. I have to call my credit card company to ask them about a charge, whatever. It's gotten better,
7 days of avoiding these like very non-consequential things, right? You're just
right. And then allowing yourself to get 100%. In trouble. You'd rather get in trouble a little bit with whatever the task is, or then you're like, I've left it go way too long now. So now I have to go into witness protection because I can never speak to that person ever again.
Picking up my half chaps from Bartville.
Oh my God.
Need to do it because they kept calling me. It's an Amish tax shop. So they can use their phone from 8 a.m. to 8:15 a.m. or something to call you and let you know that their stuff is ready. But I let it go months, and then I was this Amish lady hates me because I've not picked up my half chaps, and it like turned into a whole thing. I made Niamh go pick them up, and I'm like, did she say anything? And she's no. I just paid for them, and I'm thinking about you. Stop it. Like, I can never go there again.
She's like, she's going to look at me and be like, that's the lady that left her half chaps here for 3 months.
I know. We put these like real like weird expectations and you're like, oh, that person's never going to talk to me again. I have a client right now who's Amish and same thing. I like, he'll call me and leave a voicemail. And I'm like, okay, Shan, you're going to call him tonight. Like for sure. Tonight's going to be the night. I have three of his horses. Right. One just showed up because he left me a voicemail and I didn't listen to it because I thought it was going to be mad at me. And I, how he was going to be mad at me about listening to him, I don't know. Am I a crazy person?
I get it. I totally get it.
Okay. We're going to switch gears a little bit here and we're going to get right into the thick of it, which is the OTTB connection. So you've worked with so many.
I think they're so damn smart. They pick things up so quickly. They try so hard, so often. I don't know if there's another breed that I've ever ridden that comes out every day. It's just, yeah, let's do this thing. And 99% of the thoroughbreds that I've ever ridden have come out with this everyday enthusiasm that matches mine. And that helps. I think the thoroughbreds always give me this glimpse of what could be, right? More than even like the warm bloods. Like you'll ride a nice warm blood and like you'll feel the progress. But like the thoroughbreds, every once in a while, you'll canter down to a little oxer and they'll just jump the ever-living hell out of the jump. And you're like, that feeling, that's it. And like they give you that moment of excitement, you're like planning, you're thinking, and I so enjoy that moment with them where they get it and it clicks and they're like, yeah. And like I said, I love my warm bloods. I've had some really nice ones along the way, but they're very systematic in their development because like they've had they've never had a hard change of direction like the thoroughbreds have, right? And so the thoroughbreds, like when they get it, they're like, oh, this is new. This is exciting. This is so cool. And you feel that moment that they get it. And that's, I think, why I really always enjoy the thoroughbreds. I have a sale horse right now that he's eight. He was a steeplechaser. He's one of Jeff Redmond's. And he just gives you this feeling of, God, I could feel this horse going preliminary. Oh, it's going to. It's going to put the pieces together. Because like it hunts down to that those flags, like nothing. And that's what brings me back to the thoroughbreds. Yeah.
That's awesome. Do you remember the very first thoroughbred that you brought into your program? What stood out about that experience?
The first real off-the-track thoroughbred I have, memory-wise. Yeah.
You can fib a little if you want.
I know. Honestly,
no one's going to fact-check this episode. Maybe some of the trolls on your Facebook.
We'll get to that later.
I think Jag was probably the first thoroughbred that I kept with any intention long-term. And he's the one that I brought up through preliminary. I got into thoroughbreds because I did a lot of reselling to try and find my next upper level horse when my Tricaner mare broke right before Young Riders. So I traded her for a little warm blood colt, sold him, bought a thoroughbred. I knew I could flip in that market, right? I could do some retraining, do some sales. I had some good connections there. But it was always with the intent of finding my next upper level horse. So the thoroughbreds were always a means to, you'd see so many people that would get that one thoroughbred that took them from Pony Club to Kentucky, right? And I was so certain if I just had enough of them come through my barn, one of them would. Yeah. Unfortunately, reality of a sales program like mine and the fact that I don't have any financial backing of any sort, even when I would find those really good, exciting ones, I couldn't really actually afford to keep them at that point in my life. So I sold a few on that have gone on to do 3-star with someone else or whatever. But it was always that I could ride them. I knew how to ride them. And I knew I liked riding them. And it was an easy market for me to sell into. And I had someone who had great taste in thoroughbreds that helped me a lot.
That makes sense.
Really, yes.
That helps.
That always helps. Yeah, for sure. So tell us a little bit about your business, about Infinity Sport Horse. What's a typical week?
So there's no such thing. I am chaos incarnate. I was talking to the girls about this. Oh, guys, what do you think like a typical week here is? And they're like, you forgot to tell us one horse was coming in. So a trailer will show up at one moment. You'll have
off to some clinic you're signed up for without telling us. Three people have come to try a horse that you forgot to tell us. It's the daisies. I'm fortunate at the farm that I'm renting right now. I have a ton of great hacking and everything, so I can be here a lot more than I have in the past. And so it has been nice to, we're here a lot. We go cross-country schooling at the Vista a lot. I'm at Stableview a lot. I'm not sure there's like a typical week other than to say that I have too many horses on any given week. But yeah, that's a little bit, the week is a little bit chaos incarnate.
Asking more of a specific question about the chaos. How do you juggle training, competing, and managing?
So I really have always wanted to ride first and foremost. That's always been something I have prioritized. I like teaching, but it doesn't bring me as much joy as the riding does. So I've tried to really prioritize riding my horses, my competition horses, first in the morning. And honestly, like, nothing in my business would be possible if I didn't have great staff. I have two girls right now who are wonderful. I've been lucky all the way through my career with phenomenal people who have shown up every day, shown up with enthusiasm, shown up when it was hard, showed up when it was easy. So that it makes it very easy. I can get through 8 horses in a day without blinking because the girls can like rock through getting me on and off horses, taking care of them. I trust them implicitly to take care of the horses when I'm done riding them, which helps immensely. I think I've let go of some of my control issues in my old age, but it does make a difference because if you give other people control, obviously I'm very hands-on in like how the day in and day out sort of stuff goes, but I do try and prioritize getting on and being very focused and very intent in what I'm doing. I put my headphones in and I try and be very focused on riding the horse that I'm on. I always joke that I have a goldfish memory as far as horses are concerned, because brilliant most of my life, if we're honest. But people ask me like, oh, what's this horse feel like left or right or whatever? And I get on every day and I cannot remember what happened yesterday. So I just don't get on with preconceived notions. So I tend to just ride the horses, which I think helps. It helps, I think. And I prioritize competing. I prioritize my own lessons. I take a lot of lessons. I take lessons on my sale horses. I take lessons on my competition horses. I have an entire line item on my taxes every year for lessons. I ride with Waylon Roberts.
What trainers do you work with?
I've been show jumping with Grant Wilson quite a lot when he's in town, which has helped my show jumping quite a bit. I've had some great coaches, dressage coaches in town that I'm able to ride with pretty regularly. And whenever I'm feeling stuck in something, I show up to somebody with 4 horses. I'm like, teach me all the things on these 4 very different horses. But I do think I'm able to leave my business because I try and really empower the girls to do some of the showings, to ride the horses for the sales, for the showings, because I do think it's
Facebook sometimes about like pre-riding sale horses is very popular, especially in the hunter jumper industry,
before people come to try them. And I think sometimes when I ride a horse, I'm going to present it slightly different than maybe the girls are going to present it. And I think sometimes people will be like, I'm not going to ride it as good as you. And then they get self-conscious about how they're riding. And they're not like riding to the best of their ability because they're like, I'm not going to ride it as good as you are or whatnot. And so I've found good success in having the girls ride them, and it gives them so much education and puts the pressure on them, and they start to learn to handle a different pressure of showing horses for sale and the good, the bad, the ugly of that.
So I trust them to show the horses for me if I'm on a turn at a competition. So really, I don't
ever have to worry about, like, oh, I can't go to this show because I've got to show this horse on this weekend, or I've got a vetting on Friday. I have incredible girls that like make sure everything runs seamlessly for that.
Yeah. That's so important. And I think we certainly dealt with this when we were working together, where it was like, sometimes the horse just went a little bit better for, or Emily's really tall. And so I'm medium size. So put me on. And because people can't visualize that, they can't understand that sometimes they see somebody with long legs get on the horse, we're like, that one looks small,
and
you said it was 17
tall.
Hands, it's like, this thing is 17 hands. So yeah, it's definitely really nice to have that kind of balance. And for the vettings and everything too, I can tell you that the experience that I got from participating in and jogging horses for vettings is like some of the best experience I've ever gotten being around horses.
That's and a great education.
Great education. Having this relationship with vets where they actually talk you through what they're looking for during a vetting. I'm like, this stuff is like,
it makes such a difference. And I think there's no other way to get it than being immersed in it. And I think like, it's very easy to want to be secretive in this business. It's like the culture, and I hate it. So I really try and be as transparent with the girls as I can be about what the costs are, what the expenses are. Yeah. They see what my grain bill is. They see
the vet bills. They know what I spend money on for the vet bills. They know when I call the vet. They know why I call the vet. They know when I call a farrier.
I really feel like when they leave my program, they do know whether they want to do this or not, because that's pretty clear what it really is. So I think when I got into it, I had no idea really what it all costs. I didn't really understand how much even like just a simple vet bill would be, right? Like that it just to call a vet out, it's $350 because you're not sure if it looks a little lame. And so you do start getting better at the lameness evaluation when you sit through 90 vettings in a year. But
For sure. So in your business, when you're evaluating an off-track thoroughbred for resale, what are some of the kind of green flags, things that you look
for? My husband was a farrier for a long time, so I'm cannot see about feet. I think there's a lot of things you can fix with a good farrier, but feet are a tricky one. So I think I value good feet immensely in the off-the-track thoroughbreds. I know a lot of us like watch the jog videos on the track, and you can tell a little bit about a jog video. Mainly, I do think it's very important to learn how to judge soundness in a jog video. And I don't think that's a hard thing to learn unless you watch 9,200 fucking jog videos.
Welcome to our life world. Even though we don't buy and sell anymore, we just send them to each other constantly. One day I played a game with like our Facebook group where I was like, I have 430 tabs open in Chrome. How many of those are Equibase? I think it was like 70% of them or something. Because that's how you learn, is by honing your eye and learning how to listen for soundness and not to look for soundness.
And I think I'm a big proponent in breeding. I think that there's certain lines that I always look for that I've enjoyed working with.
Do we ask her that question at some point, Emily?
Oh, man. And it's funny. I know.
Because we're nerds about it. As well.
But I do. I know when I look at a breeding, I'm going to get slaughtered for this, but the storm cats get such a bad reputation. And I think it's so misplaced, but it does make them hard to resell. And so I do think people that love
some people love them.
I've had some phenomenal ones. And I think if you can ride a good one, like you have a great one. But unfortunately, for me, I always go back to the commercial aspect of things. You have to. And so
You have to.
Sure. I think it depends on the 100%. Other aspects of the breeding, too, right? If you have Stormcat coupled with other lines that are known to be difficult or temperamental or whatnot, then it compounds. But
right, like when I looked up my breeding, I looked up my name on Equibase the other day. There's one horse named Neve with my spelling, and it was an English Channel and a Stormcat. And everybody was like, hard pass. And Emily's like a Sky Mesa and something else. And I was like, oh, Emily,
that's hilarious.
Nice,
actually,
I had really good breeding.
Yeah. I think it's my generation, like kind of that 20 to 30 year olds really understand and looked and cared about the breeding. And I think it's a missed education point. And I'm not sure how we fix it, but like, I love it. I love it.
We're trying
because
to.
Because I do think it's important because people will look at a pedigree and go, oh, Stormcat. There will be no other discussion. There will be no other conversation.
Is it a Tale of the Cat or is it a Stormy Atlantic?
Totally.
We're talking about two totally different horses there.
That conversation isn't being had as much because they're just like, well, I've already ruled that horse out.
Is it on the dam side or is it on the sire
so much.
Line?
And so for me, like, but there's always that commercial ability of it. So I do think that I look for that. Yeah. I always look for the horse that you can see a good eye in a video, in a picture, and like what it, you're absolutely so unhelpful, kitten. I like a horse that, like, they've got a soft eye, even in the jog video. And because I do think that in the chaos mm-hmm. of the track, if they're just, yeah, this do be life, I find those are very, that's very telling about who they're going to be long term. And I'm a big proponent that you have to judge the walk, because the walk and the canter.
I was just about to ask you, I was like, if you could ask to see either the walk or the trot to pick a horse, you pick the walk every day.
Not over tracking the trot, and the canter is going to be garbage. I just...
No, it's very... Bought my RRP horse basically off of a 5-second walk video. We saw the walk and I was like, oh, that he's going to have a really good canter. Emily cantered him for the first time today and was like, this canter.
Because yeah, you can see, really
yeah,
awesome
you can see in the walk. Like, if you can see it. Being able, and again, I have 70 horses go through my barn in a year. So I watch a lot of videos of myself riding, but you do start to see the correlation of the walk and the canter. You get to see, I can improve a trot. You can improve, it's a little bit like the same thing with the jump. Yeah, a lot of times you can improve the front end. It's very hard to improve a bad hind end. So those are things that are important to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
What do you think the difference is between a horse going to a confident amateur versus one suited for a pro? What are some of the characteristics
that
you see?
So for me, it's not for the initial flat-footed walk. Like, there are some that are just never going to have it. They're never going to take that deep breath, and they're never going to find zen, as I like to say, without a lot of guidance. And I think if, as a confident amateur, you're trying to find a horse for yourself, trying to fix a walk is hard. So I try to think that my good amateur types have that, take that deep breath. They take that flat-footed walk. And even if they like get a little excited at the candle or whatever, that can come with time. But I think if they're starting off in the walk and they're at 100 in the walk, they're very unlikely to be at zero in the canter.
Yeah.
It's nice to know that you have sort of like a neutral or like a downshift or like a parking brake kind of setting where you can go, okay, if they get a bit frazzled, I can just drop the reins and let them walk off and let them go. And then we start over again. But if you can never drop the reins and get them back, then that's never going to work.
This preconceived notion that you need that hot, spicy horse to go to the upper levels. And honestly, my 3-star horse went 3-star in a leather snaffle. I mean, like, fell asleep in the start box. I don't think they have to be that fire-breathing dragon to be successful. But I do think they have to want to do the job.
Yeah.
And I always find that there's sometimes that difference between perfectly happy to do the job and, like, wants, would jump from any distance, from anywhere, with any, like, any variation of pointing towards the flags and want to float back into them. And I find that's an important trait for the professional sort of horses, that they have to look through the flags, look through the question, really want to start to anticipate. Because to me, that's what the best upper level horses do, is they start to anticipate what the next question is going to be.
Yeah.
That they're going to go here, that they're going to go there, that they're looking for something else. The amateur horse is like one of the land and almost think stop.
Yeah.
That they're going to just like, you tell me what we're going to do next. And we'll do this as a partnership. But kind of the upper level ones are like eyeing up. You've jumped the cross rail and you're coming back. And they're like, we could do that oxer. That's kind of like right there. Not really in our line, but a guy could just do it.
Yeah. I think somebody on one of the off the track or eventing Facebook groups the other day posted they were looking for a specific photo series of somebody who completely lost their reins cross country.
Oh, really?
And I think it was, I want to say it was like a Philip Dutton series, but my contribution was to it was when Kim Severson was jumping this huge hammock. I forget where it was. But it's like this iconic hammock. Yeah. And she gets a weird distance, loses her reins at the first third over that fence. And there was something to do 3 strides away. And like she lands just with her arms, just kind of like, all right, no reins, lands, somehow grabs her reins, but not enough to do anything. And the horse is just like a heat seeking missile over the second element. And I was like, Yeah, that's that kind of
horse. That's like such a totally different ride.
Yeah.
And I think you can feel it, honestly, at this point. The ones that are just perfectly happy to like go in a line, stay in a line, stay in a straight line. That's what I want for my amateurs, right? Like yeah. I have one really sweet gelding that we're bringing along with his amateur owner. And I was just like, you just want to hold, and he's green, right? He's still just learning to jump and everything. I'm like, but I promise you, if you just hold on to the next strap,
it's going to go.
He's going to go down the line. And bless his heart, he's thought about nothing else than staying straight.
Yeah.
And that's why I love him for her, because he is just genuine. When she pulls, he slows down. Like, he's mm-hmm. making no new independent thoughts. And I love him for it, because it makes him very safe. And you want to be able to have that horse that, like, you don't have to worry about every single time that you get on. That the professionals, like, I ride 6 days a week, right? Like, they go 6 days a week. They're doing something. There's always mental stimulation. I want a horse that, for an amateur, that if life gets in the way, you don't ride for 6 days. That's right. To no detriment to you or the horse.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great analogy. I really like that. Okay, so switching back a little bit to some more thoroughbred stuff. When you first get one off the track, what's your approach for those first few weeks and what do you prioritize?
So it's funny. I think a lot of people want to just kick the thoroughbreds out into a field and give mm-hmm. them the off time. So I have had very little success with doing that.
Yeah.
I find that they tend to self-harm when left to their own devices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they don't understand what you're doing. They're like, why am I out here?
I have a job.
I have a job. They like having a job. They've only ever had a job. They've had, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of times people mean to be good and mean to give them like this rest and let their body. But I do think you can do all of those things without dropping them on their face.
For sure. Yeah. And even if you're not riding them, you don't have to be riding them per se, but they do want to feel like they're doing something all the time.
Yes. And like for me, I do a ton of packing with a friend when they first come off the track, like even if it's around the field. And I always think that I walk a lot of poles. I let them try and do some groundwork. I do think groundwork is hugely important. And like finding someone to teach you good groundwork, or even just spending a lot of time watching videos, like getting a feel for your horse on the ground is so important.
I'm just chuckling because I got my RRP horse at the end of November. And when I say he's green under saddle, like he's pretty green under saddle, but I've been taking him places and doing all this stuff with him and working with him on the ground and doing all this just really intense, like emotional regulation work. And it has paid off in a way that like, I feel like I became like a new horsewoman from working with this particular horse. It's like giving me this appreciation of what was missing in his life and what needed to be implemented to the point where he was going to then be like, I'm ready for whatever you want to bring at me next.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that it's an overlooked part, and especially obviously in the culture of bring in, get done, sell.
Sure.
It's hard to be like, oh, like I have, realistically, I'd like to sell this horse in 90 days. How much time do I spend doing groundwork with it? But I like even teaching him to jump, God, I can do it so much better from the ground.
Yeah.
And if I have the coordination from the ground of their feet, I'm so much more likely to have the coordination of their feet from on top.
Yeah.
And if I can guide them in a rope halter and a lunge line over a log, I'm so much more likely to be able to do the same thing from their back.
Yeah.
And they understand the concept. They get to feel it on their own. I think
they gain a ton of confidence too, like in who they are. Like when they understand how their body can work in a new way, I think they get like a little cocky. They get really excited about it.
Self-confidence and installing self-confidence in a horse is like the most underrated ability.
Yeah.
That I think I would will that to everyone, is to teach your horse to have some self-confidence.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. Like you said, even just like going places and like doing it on the ground, and you don't even have to get on the horse at the show venue the first time. Take them on the line and let them just take a deep breath.
I took my RRP horse to a lesson in the winter. My first like off property experience with Sally Cousins, who I know so well. And I it went every poor way it could have gone.
He had such a meltdown. You were in an indoor. There were a lot of horses. It was like a kind of that booming sound when there was horses.
There was horses jumping. And I went to pull him out and I was like, why is he lathered?
Poor dude.
And I was like, oh my God. And it just, but honestly, I'm glad that happened because I was like, this horse is insecure and he has no emotional regulation. How do I find out what he's naturally gifted at? And how do I make him feel like $1 million every time I work with him? And so when I say it changed my philosophy in working with horses, this horse has really changed me.
I love, that's like the most articulate way I've heard it said. But like, how can I make this horse the best version of himself?
Yeah. And I found out that he was really good at being curious and brave. And I was like, okay, so we're just going to go to obstacle courses and we'll do them in hand. And if you're great doing them in hand, then I'll hop on you and we'll do them together. And it was like, the more like inquisitive work I threw at him, the more he was like, I'm really awesome at this. I'm so brave. I'm so curious. And I was like, we don't have a good walk, trot, canter, but guess what? I can walk into fire.
Yes. But I think all those things come, right?
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
It's so much easier to work on the trot when you're like, I have the walk.
Yeah.
I have the like, the, I have his belief in me.
Yes. So, yeah. That's a big thing.
Yeah. And so you can work the trot even from the ground. You can improve the trot and the canter of the ground if you have the curiosity, right? So, okay, maybe you don't do your trot work in the ring with that horse. Maybe you do a ton of your trot work like in the field, up and down a hill.
Yeah.
And slowly bring it to the ring. I think so many people rush a dressage test, essentially. There's no need to, some horses do just naturally walk, trot, canter, go into a ring. Right. And some good riders can make most donkeys do it, right?
Yeah, truly.
But it doesn't mean that that's the right move for every horse. I think like relaxation is the priority in the pyramid. And whether you get that from on top of them or from the ground, it's got to be the priority.
I think there's going to be a whole new pyramid that comes out in the next couple of years where emotional regulation is like more of a real crucial component of horse training.
And I think like a term that we don't associate with negatively, I think it's got to be a positive association.
Yeah.
I think some people still feel like saying you're teaching your horse emotional regulation is like akin to coming out with a carrot stick.
It couldn't be any more different than that, though.
No.
It's like when you see how they interact with one another and how they mirror one another's behavior and how, like, it just says a lot about, I think the fact that they will do anything for us is phenomenal. I think it's mind-boggling to me that these animals that are bred to be prey will accept us doing anything with them. Come on, get in this dark box that's on wheels, like all that kind of stuff. But I think that a lot of horses just do stuff because they're just, it's conditioning, right? But then I think when you have a horse that's truly emotionally in control of themselves, they will give you way more than a horse that is insecure and feeling like they actually don't, there's a missing piece.
I think that's so true. And I think it's so key. And I think it's so overlooked. Like I said earlier a little bit, that you can get so far with a genuine animal.
Yeah.
That has all the heart and all the ability and all the keys. But if you missed that emotional regulation step where they actually understand their job, then you really have nothing.
Yeah.
You don't have a foundation.
Yeah. Now, I'm really enjoying the conversations that I'm having with horsewomen, and especially in the last couple of months. It's been really awesome. Speaking of emotional regulation or just exercises and things that you like to do with green horses, what are some things that when you don't have a horse that has all the basics pre-installed, what are some things that you like to work on them with?
I like to do a lot of work on the trails and then hacking. I think you can do a ton of work with a friend and just like slow, boring ho-hum work, right? So when they go cross-country schooling with me the first time and I can sense that we're going to accomplish exactly three things today, right? I'm not going there and being like, oh, I'm going to school a water, I'm going to school a ditch, I'm going to school like 17 logs. Sometimes all we're doing is we're going to walk to this field, we're going to touch that tree and we're going to walk back and I'm going to get off.
Exactly. It's first of all, you're going to get on if you can.
Yes.
Right there.
It's reconfigure your expectations a little bit.
For me, I think the circle is so. I rode with Eric Duvander a few years ago in a clinic, and he did this exercise where basically you walked and you trotted and you cantered essentially on a 10-meter circle, and you never trotted faster than you could sit the trot.
Oh, wow.
And if you never cantered, because you just had to walk and trot, then that's what we did, and we stayed on the circle. And I was dizzy by 23 minutes in. It was such a good, you realize it's such a simple exercise. No, don't come off my inside leg. No, don't go out the outside leg. Just like between the legs, a little here, a little there. It's a hard exercise in the walk, let alone the trot. God help me if I got to the canter. But it's such a good exercise just to walk on one 20-meter circle consistently 702 times in a row. Just, can I keep this circle? How do I keep the circle? They've got to let me put their leg on. Okay, they're going to jig a little bit. That's okay. We come back to the walk. I have no other expectations, and we're just going to stay on the circle for the day.
Yeah.
Because I have made the parameters, and I've made their whole world just the circle. And the arena gets big, and I've never had a ring that had four walls on it since I've been in Aiken.
Yeah.
So the one time I had just a polo field, so you have to put your own parameters down. And so for me, sometimes it's even if it's just around a jump standard, right? Like at least I give myself a point and they're falling in a little here. I just start to incorporate my inside leg. Oh, they're falling out a little bit. You start to just teach them what those leg aids mean on this like one topic, right? You set the circle and you make that their whole world for a bit and you trot no faster than you could sit. And if you can't do that, then you just walk some more.
Yeah.
And I think it's a hugely useful exercise because you don't get ahead of yourself. You're not caring about the leads. You don't care about whether they're spooking in that corner. It doesn't matter if they're spooking. You stay on that circle. That circle is God.
I bet a lot of upper level, like top level riders would like that could show a lot of holes.
It was, the clinic I did with Eric was like only riders who had ridden at preliminary and above. And I think I think three people jumped that day.
That's so
he was like, you will learn how to canter on a f-ing circle, but we will do no more. And I learned to canter on a circle. And so it's always an exercise I go back to with any of my horses. It's like when like kind of the wheels are coming off the bus, let's go back to our circle and let's see. Cause again, same thing in like a show. Cause you can go to a show and put yourself on a 20-meter circle and that horse goes, yes, 20-meter circle.
Yeah. Carve out a little space in the warm up.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's so easy to get lost in the warm-up and doing 800 new things that you've never done at home and that you'd never do again. But warm-up, and you're doing your pre-ride. You make up these things because you see somebody else doing them. And it's, if I can just go back to being like, okay, yes, he's a little excited and he's a little up, but we're going back to the circle. We're going back to the walk. I'm not trotting any faster than I can sit. And I've done that and been like, okay, like, this is not progress past me being able to do the tiniest, idiotest, spittiest sitting trot with any version of relaxation, I skipped the test.
Sure.
Because that's not what mattered. That's not why I went there.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times we get, especially when I'm very lucky to have the privilege to say that I can do that because I'm an Aiken, right? Like where I have 900 shows on a 2-week basis, I can just be like, I do not need to go into the stressage test. I can do that in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think it's important to take the expectation away that if things go awry, that you have to still go in the arena and just make it happen. That's so unhelpful for a nervous, anxious, worried sort of horse.
Yeah. Or a worried, anxious sort of rider that didn't.
Yeah, same.
That the horse is behaving, but isn't quite ready to put the pressure on themselves or let the horse down. And we were talking about this in one of our Patreon episodes where you got to be okay with not getting your money's worth or walking away from a big name rider or just making a decision in the moment and saying, you know what? I did what I wanted to do for today. And I think we're going to come out better next time.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said, especially with the thoroughbreds. You're never, ever going to tire a thoroughbred out. Let that go to Jesus. You're never going to do that. So you're not going
to run them down.
Yeah, no, they're not suddenly going to be like, you're right. You've been on me for an hour and a half. Now I'm tired. No, never happened in my life. You have to be like, sometimes like, I had 10 minutes of really good work. And that is, you recognize you're not going to make anything today better. And just that 10 minutes was really great. Done.
And gosh, yeah. isn't it exciting, like, the next day when you bring them out and they're like, let me show you this really cool thing I learned yesterday.
Yes. Because you didn't double down and try and teach them a third new thing.
Yeah. No, right. I will say that, like, working for Emily and having her teach me for many years really taught the importance of knowing when to just say, that's plenty for today. Don't get greedy. Because I think the thing is that, like, the horse will feel really let down. I know that's anthropomorphizing them a little bit, but I think the horse will feel let down and get soured to work. And but when you can get them feeling, oh my God, you just nailed that trot to walk transition, you're done for the day. Loosen the girth. That's it.
I have one, that same amateur and her horse, and we're learning to jump and everything, but it has been, he is the most literal horse, and it's been such a great reminder to myself, because, like, literally he does the grid right, we walk, we tell him he's the best horse that's ever existed, and then we start again, and then he's, look guys, look, I did the grid again, and you're like, you're so good at this.
Yeah, you make him feel amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be a 45-minute lesson. We put these time constraints in these, I have to ride for 45 minutes so he's fit because I can't ride tomorrow, and the third Sunday of next month I'm going to have to go to, these horses are so much more fit than we naturally, than we give them credit for, and if you don't walk them in a stall 24 hours a day, then all the more so that they have this baseline of fitness, you're not going to kill them by quitting on a 10-minute very good ride.
Exactly. Like, and especially a thoroughbred, I think once they've got that base level of fitness as a young horse, it's always easier and they're always just naturally more fit than a horse that doesn't have that base on
them. Agreed.
Absolutely. All right. Now we're getting into the juicy stuff. So we're going to make this probably a 2-part episode. So we're going to have to tease that we get into the good stuff in the second part. If you like what you heard today, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. You can follow OTTB on tap on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and contact us with interview candidates and topic suggestions at ottbontap.com. We love hearing from you. Until next time, cheers.